From the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., this is Update One, the club's official podcast. It features newsworthy stories originating from the NPC facilities, as well as broader topics related to journalism, communications, press freedom, and transparency.
I'm Adam Cano, a co-chair of the National Press Club's broadcast podcast team. Joining me today is J.J. Green, the Edward R. Murrow Award-winning national security correspondent for WTOP Radio. He is also author of the new book, The Noise War: How to Fight Disinformation and Find Truth When Everything is Lying to You. J.J., welcome to Update One.
Thank you, Adam.
Let's start with you. You've been on the national security beat for a couple decades. What drew you to it and what keeps you here?
Well, the national security beat was kind of a natural for me because I have been in Washington for 30 years or so. And, you know, very little happens in this town that doesn't have a national security connection. So after several years of working at the Voice of America and covering things like Ukraine and Africa, doing a bunch of traveling, it seemed like a natural, move when the opportunity came at WTOP to go to work there. Initially, it wasn't about national security. It was just about being a general assignment reporter. But pretty quickly, they realized I had some possibilities and some opportunities. So I jumped into there on March 11th, 2004, the same day of the Madrid train bombings, and never looked back.
Wow. The preface of your book starts with October 15th, 2025. The day you handed in your Pentagon press credentials. For those who haven't heard the episode I recorded with Aaron Mehta on behalf of the Pentagon Press Association, remind our listeners what was at stake there.
Everything for us journalists. And that day we had an option: sign this memo and report only essentially what the Pentagon tells you is okay to report, or don't sign it, leave your credentials and get out. I declined to do it, along with Aaron and a lot of journalists that are way more talented than I am. We all left the Pentagon. And the objective for us was to maintain essentially our credibility, to maintain the respect that we had and the trust that we had from the audiences, from the people who had been following our reporting, in my case, for 21 years at the Pentagon. And this was what was at stake for me, everything. So there was no option.
I'll get back to the book in a minute, but since that time, has it had any kind of chilling or other effect on your reportage of the beat?
No. I mean, the only difference for me is I don't have a photograph on the wall at the Pentagon. I mean, it was nice having it. I lost that. But not having access to the Pentagon doesn't cut my access off to my reporting, my sources, my ethic, and my work. You know, I walked out of the Pentagon, but I did not walk away from my commitment to report the truth and to be honest and objective. And my responsibility and commitment to the ethics of journalism.
Absolutely. So getting back to the book, you admit that there are, you know, numerous ones that are based on the threats posed by disinformation. So what drove you to write this one and what's your angle?
10 days after that walkout, 3 o'clock in the morning on the 25th of October, 2025, I woke up startled. It was almost an anxiety or something like a panic attack. The walkout 10 days before, I was good with it. I was fine with it, you know, and didn't have any issues with it, or so I thought, until 3 o'clock that morning. You know, basically the adrenaline had worn off, you know, the phones and all the support had kind of gotten a little quieter. And it was just me and my thoughts and my dreams, I suppose. That morning I woke up and something said to me, you need to get up and get busy, because as much of a surprise, I guess relative surprise, as the requirement for us journalists to sign that memo was to us, there could be another surprise in your life that could shut down your ability to report anything. So you have to do this now, because I've been working on this book for 5 years. it was that moment that was the trigger to get this work done.
Early on, you tell the story of a person named Murat Mindiyarov, and I apologize if I got the pronunciation wrong.
But you got it right.
Who is he, and what was his experience?
Chapter one in the book talks about Murat Mindiyarov, who is a Russian. He lived in St. Petersburg. He lived just up the street or a few blocks away from what we now know as the Internet Research Agency. He didn't know it at the time what it was. He was unemployed. He walked by this building. He was basically walking up and down the streets looking for places to go to work, putting in applications. So he went there and he applied for a job there and he was hired there. And he went into this place and he, like the other people there, were given the assignment of writing things. Most of what they were supposed to write basically was to sing the praises of Vladimir Putin as president of Russia and talking about how great Russia was. A couple of weeks or a few weeks after he was there, he realized just from his own life and from his own connections to people that he knew, family, friends, that what he was writing really wasn't true. And he had a really difficult issue with doing that. So he tried to leave that post but stay in the organization. And they had another unit there, as many people know by now, called the Facebook unit, inside the Internet Research Agency. What he was doing was writing this information, this propaganda for general consumption inside Russia. But this Facebook unit was a whole different thing. He had to take a test to get into that unit. He failed the test, but it wasn't because he wasn't smart enough. It was because he was too honest. There was a question on this test that he took that asked him how would he feel about Hillary Clinton being the next president of the U.S. And this, by the way, was in 2014. Early 2015, and he answered, it would be cool. He didn't get the job, and then he started hearing drips and drabs about things that were going on and seeing things and talking to people, and he realized that this was one of the most audacious information, propaganda, disinformation operations in modern times underway in this place, this building, 55 Solveshkina Street, this gray, nondescript building in St. Petersburg. And he realized later on it was the Internet Research Agency, and their objective was to target Americans and to make Americans, confuse Americans, shall we say, about what was really happening here in our own election. And that was the part of the Murat story, I think, that was most significant in the beginning.
At the end of that and other chapters of your book, you provide sections titled Analysis, Takeaways, a Toolkit, Exercises. So how did your journalism background inform this approach?
Part of what I do as a journalist is occasionally I'll get opportunities to speak to people, groups, organizations. The Cooperstown, New York League of Women Voters asked if I would speak to them in March of last year. This is because of a connection that I have with a member of that organization, who's a friend of mine, long time, who had been following what was going on here in Washington with journalists being essentially not allowed to go into the Oval Office and on Air Force One and other things that were taking place that were pretty unsettling. And she had seen an interview that I had done with broadcasters in Germany about some of what was going on. So I spoke to them, and at the end of the conversation, and it wasn't kind of out of the blue, but it kind of did strike me when it took place, there were questions and answers, but there were so many questions about what do we do? How do we deal with disinformation? What are the steps to recognizing it? How does it impact us? So those were all things that I realized after that conversation should be a part of any book. Bottom line, Adam, there are lots of great, shiny, beautiful books out there. But if you ever see this book, I call it The Ugly Duckling. It's a little yellow book with black and blue writing on the front of it. It's 95 pages. You can read this book in an hour, and there are places in there where you can actually scribble your notes. You're encouraged, if you have the paperback, to do that. And these exercises, the toolkit, the takeaways, and the analysis at the end of each chapter are very short, but the objective is to give people some guidance after setting up, using these short stories, like the one with Marat, to set up the problem, and then give people some understanding of how to attack the problem, because it impacts us all personally. Like Marat's story, personally what he did was, he said, no, I'm not doing this, he quit, and he spoke out about it. But that's what these little sections at the end of the book are designed to do. It's not a book that you put your feet up with to escape with. This book is a book that you get it, lace up your boots, you throw it in your backpack, your briefcase, or your bag, and you hit the streets. You go to work with it.
I want to run through the three sections real quick, but before that, you dedicate a chapter to what you call the thin line between misinformation and disinformation. So yeah. For you, what's the difference and what's the nuance?
Well, the difference is this. Disinformation is, first of all, it's a lie, or an image that lies, or visuals, or it's an attempt to essentially proliferate an untruth deliberately. Misinformation can often be a mistake. And in some cases, it's not a mistake. But the difference is, sometimes there's a very thin line between how misinformation can become disinformation. For instance, there's a story in there in this chapter that sets it up about COVID and the vaccines, which is really when this work started. And there was, again, a Russian outfit that reached out to influencers around the world, and it offered to pay them money to write pieces about how the Pfizer and Moderna and the other vaccines were killing people in the U.S. and weren't effective. And one of the influencers, a German, got suspicious and wrote to this company that offered to pay him, and discovered that it was a front for a larger marketing operation. They were positioning themselves as a company out of London, but it turned out through his research, he found out that they were actually based in Moscow. And the objective was more disinformation. And so that was one of the ways in which they used misinformation very judiciously. I mean, they would take things that wouldn't necessarily seem wrong, and there is some element of truth to them, but they would pitch them in a way, write them in a way, position them in a way that it applied to something that it completely doesn't apply to. For instance, they were talking about how so many people died from getting vaccines in the U.S., these, COVID or whatever vaccines. I mean, they were talking thousands of people, right? But the thing was, many people died after they got vaccines of other conditions. Sure. And so that's how they were able to use that misinformation, turn it into disinformation, and that's therefore the thin line.
So the first section of the book defines the problem. The second offers what you call strategic countermeasures. Now, I was particularly struck by what you phrased as, collective defense, a NATO for journalism. Explain that.
Yeah, NATO for news. I think I brought this up one day over at the Pentagon, and this was right at the very beginning of this whole journey that we've been on in the last year, the media in Washington, and certainly, not too far into the last year, a number of reporters and outlets were basically pushed out of the Pentagon. Legacy, long-term mainstream broadcasters, writers, and television, were pushed out. And one of the things that occurred to me after just talking with some people, and certainly being a national security correspondent for 20 years at that point, I've been embedded many times. I've been to 54 countries, and I've seen what the relationship between the U.S. and NATO was. and how NATO functioned. But I also, on 9/11, was standing on the roof of the VOA building watching the Pentagon burn after the attack from Al-Qaeda. And that day, we didn't know at the time that the plane that crashed in Shanksville was actually destined for the Capitol, which is about a couple hundred yards from where we were standing. So bottom line, had that plane not, had those brave souls on that plane not brought it down, then we and many other people in Washington very likely would have been killed or at least seriously injured in that situation. But it was that day that the first and only time that Article 5 of the NATO treaty was put into effect. And that is that if one country, one member of NATO is attacked, then all respond. Every single country in NATO stepped up that day to come to the U.S.'s aid. And so when I started thinking about what was going on with journalists, many of them in the new in the Pentagon press corps worked for outlets that have foreign roots, you know, that have roots overseas. So I thought, and someone else mentioned this to me too, that this might be a good way to pull journalists together. So hey, I said, hey, how about a NATO for news? If one journalist is attacked, then all of us, we need to stand up for each other. And what we do, how the way we do that is, you know, form these agreements, form these pacts, do these things. If somebody goes after a journalist and tries to tarnish or target that journalist, and others who know that it's a good, credible, and reputable and respectable journalist, step up and say so. Do that in a public way. And that's just one of the ways in which collective defense for journalists would work. And I won't belabor you with all of the details and nuts and bolts, but that's essentially how that concept would work.
The third section of the book is called Building Resilience, and I noted that one of your quoted sources was former CIA and NSA director, retired Air Force General Michael Hayden. Talk a little bit about how he characterized the problem and the remedy that he prescribed.
One of the things that General Hayden said was, right now in America, and by the way, this book is apolitical. This is not designed to go after any political party or entity in a political party. Disinformation, the problem with disinformation is it's something that individuals cause, individuals purvey. They use organizations in the process, but I just want to make sure that that's clear up front. I should have done that a little earlier, but I spoke with General Hayden about the problem, and he said the problem we have now is that there are so many people, and on both sides of the aisle, he was essentially saying, that use information which may essentially be disinformation instead of truth because it's inconvenient for their narrative. The narrative they want to push, you know, may not be as strong if they don't throw some lies in there, essentially. And so what he was suggesting is we need to get back to the point where truth is paramount and most important and treated that way, and not something that's used only when it's convenient. It has to be used in the way that makes it most effective, and that is always. And he says the best way, this is a civic responsibility, mm-hmm. is what he was saying, yeah. essentially. Civics. I don't know, a lot of people took civics in school, but I don't know that that happens anymore. I think actually it does, but there was a time when there wasn't so much emphasis on it. But what he said was, we need to get back to the point where children are taught civics in school. Mm-hmm. They're taught to ask, why is this? Why is that? Is this true? Is this not true? You know, that's the kind of thing that he thinks will eventually, and I agree with him, begin to remedy and address the issue of disinformation, is getting us as people used to this idea of truth being paramount, truth being the only way to essentially approach a topic. There are no alternative facts. It's a fact or it's not. And just one other thing, there have been countries that have done this, like Finland, which this is really remarkable what they've done. They've, through, I think it's a government process, set up these scenarios where people in communities, if there's somebody in a community that gets a hold of something that they believe is disinformation, I mean, this is because of decades, centuries, I suppose, of disinformation coming from the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union and Russia. They've learned how to defend themselves, and they have people in communities, community leaders, a minister or a business leader. They have these groups that actually knock down disinformation, and it's a process. It's an actual part of the way these communities work. When something comes in there that is like that, they'll attack it from that perspective. But that's essentially what General Hayden was talking about, is we need to get to the point now where we take disinformation seriously and address it that way.
In the fourth and final section of the book, you speak with a Belarusian exile who paints a stark and frankly terrifying picture of a society where information has become Orwellian. What's the lesson?
The lesson is we really need to protect facts. We really need to protect the integrity of truth. And this Belarusian national, this woman that's exiled, her name is Natalia Belikova. She lives in Poland now. And she told me the story back a couple days after I had that moment where I woke up in the middle of the night and realized I needed to do this. So a couple days later, I was in Brussels at a conference on connecting media. And she told me, I asked her for an interview for the book, and she told me, she said, you know, in Belarus, they have an entire system that is set up, the entire government, every element of the government, whether it's people that work in the office of the leader, Alexander Lukashenko, right down to police officers and people who work, civil servants jobs. This whole construction of the government in that country, everybody has a role. And what they've done, she says, is they've created an entire alternative reality. They've co-opted words. For instance, words like patriotic and democracy all now have to do with people. How patriotic are you about Alexander Lukashenko, the dictator that runs that country? Democratic is a word that's applied to democracy in terms of how he is essentially conducting business there. It has nothing to do with being able to and free to choose your leaders. They have just changed the definitions of words like democracy and patriotic to make them reflect the need to support the regime. And it just runs right down through how people are able to get homes, apartments. You know, if you have somebody in your family that may speak truth and they get wind of it, they will come after you. And this is what she's warning us about. You know, the bottom line on it is we have to protect truth in this country. She said the U.S. has always been that country to do that. We have to protect truth here, because if we don't, we could end up like that.
So last question, and you've sort of prefaced it, but you conclude in the book, the defense of truth begins not with institutions, but with individuals who choose to seek clearly or to see clearly when others look away. So, you know, bringing it back to this podcast and the National Press Club, as journalists, as communicators, what can we do?
There are several things, but I'll be brief. First one is don't be afraid. Fear not. We were not born with the spirit of fear. That's something we learn as we grow and we get older. Don't be afraid. There is a way to deal with this. Number two, stay calm, because disinformation is designed to prey on our frailties as humans. We don't fall for disinformation because we're stupid. It's most times because we're human. And it has to do with the fact that we have anger, we have fear, we have rage. Disinformation is designed to get in there and drive wedges in between all of us and cause these problems. But the real, very last thing I'd like to say, the real truth here is that we as journalists need to help people figure that out. And we can't tell people to do these things because we want them to. Alexander Pope put it best. He said, men must be taught as if you've taught them not, and things forgot, and things unknown, rather, presented as things forgot. So in other words, we have to meet people where they are, treat them respectfully, but show them gently where it is we're trying to lead them. And as journalists, we just keep speaking the truth day in and day out.
JJ, thank you.
Thank you, Adam. I really appreciate this. And I really appreciate the fact that you know so much about this and were so interested, because I have to say this, you were the first of all people when you saw this book to reach out and say, hey, we need to talk about this. So thank you.
First and hopefully not the last. JJ Green is author of The Noise War, How to Fight Disinformation and Find Truth When Everything is Lying to You. For Update One in Washington, I'm Adam Cano.
You have been listening to Update One, the official podcast of the National Press Club, the world's leading professional organization for journalists and a vigorous advocate of press freedom worldwide. If you have any questions or comments about Update One, send an email to updateonepodcast@gmail.com.